Attention, attention all personnel. It's MASHcast.
Hello and welcome to MASHcast, the show that analyzes and celebrates episode by episode the greatest TV series of all time, MASH, which aired on CBS from 1972 to 1983. Proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network, I'm your host, General Robert Iron Guts Kelly, and joining us this week in the VIP tent is returning VIP, Colonel Scott X. Hi, Scott.
Hey, Rob. It's good to be back here in the VIP tent. I know I've been away a while. I spent some time bouncing around a little bit. Worked as a salesman for the Style Right Shoe Company out of Storm Lake, Iowa, which, as you know, sell high-style wingtip shoes. Unfortunately, it turns out that no one really wears that style of wingtip shoes anymore.
That's so sad.
So I had to give it up and return to being an occasional podcast guest.
I said you've been on the network in between your last MASHcast appearance, but I'm always glad to have you back here.
Well, great. I'm glad to be back as well.
All right. So, well, we're here to talk about the season finale of MASH Season 3, Episode 24, Abyssinia Henry. The original air date was March 18th, 1975, written by Jim Fritzell and Everett Greenbaum, and directed by Larry Gelbart. So I said, of course, since Scott has been on the show before, we can get right to this groundbreaking episode. While in the OR, Radar comes in with some amazing news. Henry is going home. He's got all his points. He's been discharged. Everyone is happy for Henry, if a little worried what the 477 will be like after he is gone. Frank and Margaret, though, are, of course, overjoyed. Frank will now be in command. Henry calls his family, telling them he's coming home. Henry and Radar pack up Henry's things, and they have a moment where Radar partially admits to looking at Henry like a father. Henry gives Radar a present, a thermometer that was his father's. It isn't oral, is it? Radar asks nervously. Later that night, Hawkeye and Trapper throw Henry a goodbye party at Rosie's bar, where they all get plastered, even Radar. Their goodbye gift is a brand new suit, handmade in Seoul. The next morning, everyone is in formation to see Henry off. He comes out wearing the suit, a pinstriped three-piece number, complete with snap-brim fedora. He gives personal goodbyes to Hawkeye, Trapper, Klinger, Father Mulcahy. Hawkeye whispers something in Henry's ear, leading him to throw caution to the wind by planting a big, long, passionate kiss on Margaret to the hooting of the camp. Up on the chopper pad, some wounded arrive, and Henry starts to take a look. Hawkeye and Trapper insist Henry's been fired, and they tell him to get on the chopper. Just as he's about to take off, he sees Radar on the edge of the pad, standing in attention with a teary-eyed salute. Henry comes back, says goodbye to Radar, and hugs him. He then boards the chopper and leaves. Later, we find the 477th in surgery. Radar walks in looking dazed. He announces, in a flat, rote manner, "I have a message. Lieutenant Colonel Henry Blake's plane was shot down over the Sea of Japan. It spun in. There were no survivors." The camera pans across the OR. Frank is wide-eyed. Margaret is crying. Father Mulcahy is clutching his crucifix. Someone drops an instrument on the floor, and in the silence, the bang echoes loudly. Klinger, assisting the doctors, seems focused on his job, while Hawkeye and Trapper continue working, pausing only for a moment to look up in disbelief. So, Scott, when you became a fan of MASH, when you started learning what the show was, did you know already going in that this was an event in the show's history?
Well, it's kind of funny because I watched MASH, as we talked about, in probably my very first episode as a young kid. But this particular episode would have aired when I was like 2 years old.
Right.
So this was not something that I had seen live as I had in the later seasons. And of course, I knew that there had been another colonel. I knew Colonel Potter better. And when it came back to this, I'd seen all the reruns. I'd seen all this stuff. And I knew Henry Blake was gone, but I don't know that I knew that he died. I never saw this episode with that ending. And I'm convinced, apparently, we'll talk about that a little bit later down the road. Apparently, there was some reruns or rebroadcast of this episode where that last scene was cut.
I saw that. That's insane.
Yes.
That's insane.
And I don't know if I saw one of those and I never knew. And when I was in college, I watched MASH a lot, you know, just in between stuff. And I remember watching this episode. And on that version that I saw, that scene was in there. And I remember feeling like I had been kicked in the gut.
Mm-hmm.
And I just couldn't believe it. And this was in 1990 or something that I probably saw that episode with that actual scene. And it just floored me. I couldn't believe it. So I knew he was gone, but I didn't know he had died in the show.
Right. this episode in particular was probably the first MASH episode that really pierced what you would know as sort of the pop culture firmament, and that there were references to it in other things. It grew outside of the show itself. As popular as MASH was, and it was massively popular in its second and third, fourth, fifth, you know, ongoing seasons, this thing became something that lots of people knew of, even if they had never seen the show. And we will get into some of the references that have gone on, of course, in the greater culture referencing this. But, I mean, the show itself would make mention of Henry Blake in later seasons, and the fact that he was gone. And right. And one of the things that I thought always gave the show an extra little bit of a knife to the ribs a little is the idea that, okay, I mean, odds are MASH was never going to kill off another character because, you know, you did it once. You right. can't really do it a second time. But at the same time, you've let the audience know, hey, you know, yeah, this is a sitcom, but not everybody is safe. You know, this is what could happen. And all credit in the world to Larry Gelbart and Gene Reynolds and Burt Metcalf and all the people that worked on this show for doing this. Because, and we've talked about this in previous episodes, when a show is this popular, and MASH was, it was one of the most popular shows on television, there is such pressure from the network to just do the same show. Just keep delivering the pizza the same way everybody likes it. Don't rock the boat because you might ruin it. And, you know, for these guys to do this, for them to take the show and its audience as seriously as it did, to say, you know what, people didn't always make it back home from a war, and it wasn't just soldiers that were getting shot at. It was even people kind of on the periphery of the war could die. Was an extraordinary thing for them to try and pull off. And I was doing some research. They did get a lot of hate mail about this. They got, and you mentioned that when I saw that piece of trivia that there were some syndicated broadcasts of this episode with that scene cut out, is just gobsmacking. You just can't believe it. Like, well, what's the show then? I mean, it just ends with them on the chopper pad. I'm like, what? You know, to me. Editing that scene out is equivalent to saying, you know what, we would have less COVID cases if we just stopped testing. You know, you're like,
right,
what?
Right.
It's out there. It's already – you people know it's out there. You're just cutting the scene for no reason. So that was just – you know, again, I can only imagine the risk they must have taken. And, of course, it's MASH lore that the cast, except for Alan Alda, was not informed that that's what they were going to do. Now, the rumor was always that the scene in the show that we see was the first take, and that was the one where they all learned about it for the first time. That's not accurate. Apparently,
right.
They did a first take, and there was a technical glitch, so they had to redo it. But still, they were hitting the actors with this right before they shot it. Apparently, they told them all, hey, we got to come back in just for one more scene. Here are the pages. And they handed everybody the pages. And there's even apparently something Larry Linville said, effing brilliant or something like that when he read it.
Yeah, he did. Yeah. I actually have there's an interview on YouTube that Larry Gelbart did.
Oh, okay.
And you can watch it. And he talks about that whole process, very specifically about what happened. And it was, like you said, it was fascinating. He says that when they first did the script, they had asked the writers to, how did he say it? They said, we want a show that's going to be a goodbye show to Henry. We want no great plot or anything like that, just a goodbye show, and Henry's going to die at the end. Mm. And then the writers were sworn to secrecy, and the only one they told was Alan Alda, because by that time he'd become the star of the show.
Right.
And Gelbart goes on to say, he said, we kept it secret to prevent the information from influencing the actors' performances.
Right, of course.
Thought if they knew that Henry was going to die at the end, how they would approach those goodbye scenes would play out very different, which I think is a salient point. You know, and then he goes on to say they rehearsed the episode, they shot the episode. When everything else was shot, he just asked the crew to relight the OR for one more scene, which while they were doing that, he says that he and Gene Reynolds gathered the cast. He pulled out a manila envelope that had that last page for the scene that they had yet to shoot, and he passed them all out. They were each given a copy. He said at that point, even still then, only the cast knew, not the extras, not the crew, anybody else. And he said they all read it. And just what you said, he said, Larry Linville said, that is effing brilliant. Mm-hmm. At which point, Gary Berghoff turned to Stevenson and said, you'll probably win the Emmy for this, you son of a bitch. At which then they shot the scene. And then we'll talk a little bit about there as we go through that. And that's how it was. Yeah, exactly. It was mapped out. And for me, like you said, this was an episode that for me really turned the show in a new direction. I think at least for the majority of the viewers at that time, this was a situation comedy. And I think the producers and the creators thought of it as something a little different, as did some of the actors. And from here, it went from being sort of a comedy with dramatic elements to more of a drama with comedic elements, which is what I think they wanted it to be from the very start.
Yeah, I found every time they mentioned Henry Blake in later episodes, and to me there's just this ghostly pallor that hangs over it because you know of the deep wound. I mean, I think the again, not to get off this episode already, but like there's the best moment to me in the clip show, Our Finest Hour in episode 7, where they refer to this moment, and there's this, you know, interstitial sync with Radar, and he talks about, you know, how people can disappear, and you could tell him he starts getting choked up, and then he goes, I don't want to talk about this anymore. Right. And you know that, like, he's still, like, that he can't even discuss it because it's so upsetting. And again, I just found that the way that this moment hung over the remaining 7-8 seasons of the show, to me, is underscores how powerful it was. Again, because you loved Henry Blake so much. He was so sweet. And, you know, when you do watch the show as a viewer, it does hang over your head. Like the scene, I mean, there's the opening scene in the OR where, you know, Henry snaps at Frank because Frank's just being a real jerk because they're stuck about singing the songs. And they learn a bit. He learns that he's going home. And then the very next scene where he is going to be talking to his family, it breaks your heart because you realize he has an infant son that he's never seen. And, you know, he talks to his wife and they get cut off because of the phone call ends. And you realize, God, that's the last time he's ever going to speak to his family.
And yeah, there was no real closure in that conversation.
No, you know, and I mean, as brutal as it must be to lose someone in a family, in your family overseas while they're fighting in a war, to know to lose them on the flight home, they were as close as they could be until they touched ground, it's got to be just so absolutely devastating. And for the show to do this is just, again, for a show to F with its audience in a good way, not to, you know, sometimes you can F with the audience in a bad way just to be shocking for its own sake or whatever.
Right.
You know, I mean, there's lots of examples I can give where some creative choice has been made kind of just to give an FU to the audience, and then you're like, well, I can remember just an example. I can remember going to see Alien 3 in the theaters, and in the first 5 minutes, we find out Newton Hicks are dead. I'm like, what? And I turned the movie off in my brain at that point. I was like, oh, screw you, movie. You know, like you just,
right.
But this doesn't do that. This to me deepens the show. It adds such a resonance to the show that the idea that they would do it the way they did it is just so unbelievable. And to watch all the actors, all the characters, you know, obviously react in different ways. Frank is assuming he's going to take command. And that's, you know, they're immediately just so happy about that he's like, oh, I'm going to be in command. Like, they really aren't even thinking about Henry. It's all about upward mobility for
right.
the two of them.
What a surprise.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I think, you know, kind of going back to what you said, too, apparently Larry Gelbart and Gene Reynolds had visited Korea between seasons 2 and 3. And it was my understanding in reading some of the stuff that I've read that really strengthened their views on the horrors of war.
Right.
And like you said, Larry Gelbart in that interview also said, he said, you know, that we had no intention of killing off Henry Blake, you know, whatever McLean Stevenson's issues were. And we can talk a little bit about that moving forward. But he said, but once we knew that McLean was going to leave, he said that we wanted to use that character's departure in, he quoted as saying, some meaningful fashion. Mm-hmm. MASH was not about everyone having a good time. MASH was not about happy endings. And Gene Reynolds said, we didn't want Henry Blake going back to Bloomington, Illinois, and going back to the country club and the brown and white shoes because a lot of guys didn't get back to Bloomington. Mm. basically said, tonight, if we turned on the TV set, we would see 15 people knocked off. They don't complain about it because it's an unfelt violence. It's unfelt trauma, and that's not good. I think that if there is such a thing as the loss of life, there should be some connection. And we did make a connection. It was a surprise. It was somebody they loved. They didn't expect it, but it made the point. People like Henry Blake are lost in war. And that's just kind of what you said. You know, his wife, in story, Lorraine went from the elation of, "Woo, my husband made it.
Yeah.
He's over there in this war and conflict. He made it. He's coming home," to the exact opposite of that, to find out, like you said, he died on his way home. I mean, the ups and downs of that within the show story had to be incredible. And I'm sure also in that generation where people were watching this in the 70s, a lot of people felt that story too, from World War II, from Korea, and everything else.
Yeah, I mean, we have to remember this show was
Vietnam.
On. Yeah, I mean, right. This show was on. This show started while the Vietnam War was still going on. Vietnam had pretty much just ended by this point. March of 1975. But nevertheless, it was. And people have said, you know, obviously Vietnam was the first TV war where you could see literal footage of it every day.
And yes.
We talk about body counts and talk about how many people we lost in any given day. And that was, you know, yes, MASH was about Korea, but it really was about Vietnam, or really any war in a lot of sense. But you can't remove it from that context.
Right.
And, you know, again, there's something about, like, the idea of someone has left your life and then they just never return and you never really get that closure is something that I think the show really wanted to you know, hit upon.
Sure.
I think about other ideas like this. I mean, there's that line in Bruce Springsteen's Born in the USA where the lead kid, the guy singing, talks about his brother. And he talks about fighting off the Viet Cong. They're still there. He's all gone. And it's just gone. Like, there's no funeral. There's no body. This person's just out of your life. And it's incredibly powerful. And again, to do it in a show where, like we just talked about in the previous episode, White Gold, which is one of the silliest episodes MASH ever did. And then to just completely pull the rug out from you in the next episode is just ballsy as all get out.
And not only that, we're talking about how they had the balls to do this, but we see this now.
Mm-hmm.
But then this was like probably, if not the first time in television history where a major character of a comedic show was killed off in a dramatic way.
Yeah.
I don't know that it had ever been done before. So not only were they doing something in show, changing the direction of the show, this is something from a television history standpoint that was not out there. Like you said, we have sort of these ubiquitous shock moments now all the time in TV and movies and everything else. But that was not done at that time.
No.
And they got flack from it from CBS and 20th Century Fox Studios too, not just the fans.
Yeah. Yeah, CBS didn't like it. 20th Century Fox didn't like it. And again, it says something about the power that Larry Gelbart and Gene Reynolds and all the crew had, that they could push this through, that they could say, nope, we're doing it. That's it.
Yeah.
I mean, they didn't have the ability to do it. And so, it's hard. You can't watch this show not knowing what's happening, and it does pull a cast over everything. The scene with Henry and Radar in Henry's office is very sweet, where Radar is trying to talk about that basically Henry's been like a father to him. He mentions that his father didn't have him until he was 63, and they had a stroke when he was 2 years old. And so
they were playing peekaboo.
He never really had a father. And so he looks to Henry, and he gives him this the whistle with the fob on it, and it, you know, he got it engraved. And then Henry gives Radar the thermometer. And even that, even in such a sad sort of soap mopey scene, they find a way to get a laugh where he gives him the gives him the thermometer, and there's that pause, and he's like, "It isn't oral, is it?" And he says, "No." He's like, "My father liked to get the information from the horse's mouth, as it were." Which is,
he was accuracy was important to him.
Stickler for accuracy, yeah. So,
did you notice? And this is something that I had sort of noticed, but I didn't know if it was on purpose. And then again, that interview with Larry Gelbart talks about, you were talking about that scene, the scenes in his office, where Gelbart says, He said, this is something that I did not do, he said, but I did a directorial touch in those scenes. He said, in every shot of Henry in his office, there was a skeleton there too.
Oh,
and I did that as a bit of foreshadowing.
Oh my
God. Not something to be, that people would pick up on, but something that was very subtle, but that wouldn't give anything away. And so when I went back and watched the episode, yep, there's that skeleton hanging there on the phone. The skeleton's behind him. He's talking to Radar. The skeleton's behind him.
Oh my.
So he was foreshadowing the end of the story there too.
In all these years, I've never noticed that. I mean, they've had that skeleton in Henry's office before. So it's not like they put it in just for this episode. So you don't really notice it, but wow. Oh,
but he made sure in many of those scenes that skeleton was there in the office scenes.
Oh, yeah. Lord. Oh, God. following that scene, they have the big party at Rosie's bar. This is a minor note in terms of the show's history, but this is the first time we see the inside of Rosie's bar. We've seen it from the outside, but now we're seeing it for the first time on the inside. Guest actors wise, Kimiko Hiroshi, I'm not sure how you pronounce that name. She's the older lady who brings the sake. She has credits in a show like she was on China Beach, probably MASH's most direct descendant. She's in the movie Blade Runner. She did four other MASHes, and they all are historic episodes. She's in Welcome to Korea. She's in Fade In, Fade Out. So, I mean, they brought her in when they needed a big transition episode.
Yeah.
And then the other actress, the one that sings America, is Virginia Ann Lee, who is in four MASHes, and she was most famous for playing The Moose. She was Lee in The Moose. So she's back here. And then she also was in Welcome to Korea. She's the family that Hawkeye and BJ and Radar meet when they talk about the girls in the minefield and stuff. So those are the actors here. And I love this scene of the four of them just getting pie-eyed on the sake and stuff. And they start going through some of their adventures. And I love TV shows that establish there are other adventures of the characters that we never saw.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, in thinking like in Star Trek, they're always like, you know, case log or whatever, or captain's log. You know, some shows, the only adventures we're seeing are the ones that were being shown. But here they talk about that Father Mulcahy caught Henry messing around with a lady war correspondent and begging off, saying he was giving an interview on the importance of clean underwear, which is, of course, something we never saw. So there's lots of other adventures of the 477. They could do a whole nother MASH series with those in between scenes that we never got to see.
We could do animated shows now. We could have comic books. We could do all kinds of alternate media to fill in the gaps in those adventures.
Exactly. So again, I love that. I love that they get him the suit this wonderfully. And then unlike the one that they got for Trapper, these pinstripes are going the correct direction, which is nice. They're vertical for once. And I love these, like, I love McLean Stevenson's performance in this. I love when they're drumming him out of the military and he's like, you know, Lieutenant Ken would be like, yo. And then he's like, we're driving out of the military, Henry. Hot dog. He's just so excited. He's just like, you know, Mayor Clean Stevenson did a great drunk. He really did. He always did a wonderful drunk. And then, of course, when he talks the whole bit about how did you figure out what size I need for my suit? He's like, I traced you when you were asleep. And he's just so proud of himself.
I love that line. I don't know why that struck me as so funny, but it was just the idea of Radar going in there and tracing him and Henry not waking up. And how do you get a paper behind him? I mean, in my head, I'm thinking all these things and it just makes me laugh every
time. How did he do that? Yeah, and then I love the bit with Hawkeye and Trapper. He's like, stand up straight. I am sitting straight. The country's crooked. And then Henry comes in, and everybody's gone, and he's, oh, my gosh. Great. These guys are just having so much fun being drunk. I feel a little bad that Klinger's not in on it. You know, I just feel like Klinger might have been included, but I understand they probably wanted to keep it, you know, keep it tight of just the regulars at this point. And so they give him the box. He's like, a box. I got a box. And he's all excited about that.
Yeah, there's something in the box, Henry.
Yeah,
no, that's not just what it is.
Yeah. So then
I liked the comment too, and they were saying goodbye and they said something about how he looks sharp. Well, yeah, if you're Adolf Menju. Mm. Which I didn't know what that meant at
Me
first,
neither.
So I had to go look it up. Well, apparently Adolf Menju was a film actor who was voted best dressed man in America nine times.
Yep.
So that was the thing, that he was looking fine in his wingtip shoes, which, by the way, were the same ones that Radar was selling.
The Style Right,
The Style Rights he had on, and then he had his suit and was in his fedora on his way out.
They mention Adolph Manjou in an issue of Justice League of America, because it's a guy in a suit with a mustache. And back then, I didn't know who that was, but I knew the reference from MASH. Like, I knew, I was like, okay, Adolph, because I was like, I still don't know who Adolph Manjou is, because this is the 80s and there's no internet. But I knew the name. I'm like, okay, oh, that's the guy they mentioned on MASH. So he must be famous for being just like a well-dressed guy. I didn't realize like he was an actor and that's, you know, how he got famous. But so I was like, oh, there's two references to Adolph Manjou. Still don't get it, but I know he can make a
but
connection.
There's got to be something to
something
it.
About
because
this
two
guy.
Two things I love have mentioned it.
Exactly, exactly. It's like all I needed was to be in a Bob Dylan song. It would have been a trifecta. So then the next morning, Frank, of course, is already in charge, and he's already being a massive dick because he can't help himself, and he's making Radar play the trumpet, and then he does the whole bit about, does the colonel want to inspect his troops? And Henry's just like, no, I just want to say goodbye. And, okay. And then he goes through the line, and he said, I love that Hawkeye and Trapper are in their robes. They did not even bother to show up in their fatigues.
Like always, they look like they're just stumbling out, like they've just woken up, no matter what time of day this may be.
Yeah. Yeah, it's great. And again, Henry's suit is wonderful. Like, I love that. I love that fedora and the whole bit. And yeah, he's thanks for the outfit. It's really dressy. And he's like, you know, the suit is really you. Because if you're Adolph Manjou, and they say he moves down the line. And it's interesting to me. I always wonder like how they assemble these things. Like, he says goodbye to Gwen, Gwen Farrell, who was one of the regulars. Like, you would think maybe Kelly would have been in the front line there. We see her. She's behind Mulcahy. And then he says goodbye to Father Mulcahy, who gives him a blessing. And there's a great moment there where where Father Mulcahy gives him the cross. And then McLean Stevenson just has this very quiet pause, and he just goes, thank you, Father. And he's like, he means it.
Yeah.
You know, we never got the sense that Henry was particularly religious. He never went to any of Father Mulcahy's lectures. But in that moment, like, he really does appreciate that. The read on the line I always found very touching, where he may not be Catholic, but he means it. He really means it when he says, thank you, Father.
I really felt like there was a lot of that in this episode. Like, in the scenes where Radar and Henry were in the office together, it really looked to me like McLean Stevenson was saying goodbye as an actor, and it was showing up in his performance of Henry Blake. Like, you know, he knows he's not going to be back the next season.
Yep.
I don't think he knew he was going to be killed in the episode, but he did know that he was saying goodbye to these people that have become friends to him and his you know, family. With that, in that respect as well, and that showed in his performance. It was I thought, like you said, kind of touching, just how he delivered his lines in this.
Yeah, it's he means, he realizes this is the last thing he's going to get to say to these people. And then of course Klinger is in Klinger's greatest outfit of all time, which is his Carmen Miranda outfit with the bananas and the fruit and everything else on top of it. Just absolutely marvelous. Even so, that outfit's going to get you that Section 8. And then before he leaves, of course, Hawkeye gives him the advice, which is, you think I should do it? Why not? And he plants this big kiss on Margaret, and, you know, which is, I think Margaret has now officially kissed all the doctors on MASH. She's kissed Hawkeye.
And all the generals and most of the other generals. Officers.
Radar, Father Mulcahy, and Klinger are the only ones she hasn't kissed. And she'll even kiss Father Mulcahy at some point later on in the show. So she gets a big – and I love that when they're walking – they're all walking Henry up to the chopper pad. If you notice, you'll see Frank looking at Margaret. And I think he's a little nervous. You know, he's a little like, okay.
And I don't think Margaret seems too disappointed with the kiss either. She had a nice smile on her face when that ended.
So then the chopper pad arrives. And, of course, Henry is immediately being a doctor. And he says, this kid's a little shocky. And they're like, yeah. He says, Henry, you know, get out of here. You're fired. And he gives him just one final, have a good trip. Take it easy, pal. And then right as he's about to get in the bubble, he sees Radar saluting him, and he comes over and he gives him this wonderful little final goodbye, where he says, you know, you come back, you, and I'm just jump to it right now. This is my favorite line in the show, where he says, you behave yourself, I'm going to come back and kick your butt, which is a wonderfully touching, you know, faux macho thing, but he's still being the dad, you know, he's still being his dad. It's like, you behave, I'm not going to be around, but you better behave or you're going to be in trouble. And that's exactly what you would want your dad figure to say to you when he's leaving.
Yep, and as Radar, as the son figure, it's hard to pick up the audio, but to me he mouths, "Yes, sir."
Oh, really?
I didn't as you would that. Say, in especially in that time period, to your father. Yes,
yeah.
sir.
Yes, sir. And now we have this final shot of the whole cast at the chopper pad as the chopper is taking off. And this, again, it features another amazing moment of where it's the reverse shot where they're all waving, and Mulcahy is waving his hat, and there's Frank and Margaret. Klinger is waving. Trapper's got his hands in his pockets, and Radar is, you could see he's still holding the salute. And then we see that it's hard to see because it's a faraway shot and it's a little fuzzy, but you see that Radar is probably crying because he's adjusting his glasses. And then there's this great, nice moment where Hawkeye walks, and the camera is already starting to fade to the next scene, but you see Hawkeye go over and just hug Radar.
Yeah.
Just put his arm around him. And I can't tell you how many times I saw this episode. It probably wasn't until I got the DVDs where I could freeze frame and go back to it that I even noticed that. That it's he goes over there just silently. I mean, maybe not silently. They didn't have any audio. But just the fact that he hugs Radar right there is such a great – that he notices that Radar is just you know, crushed. And he goes over and gives him the hug, and I think it's great. And then, of course, they fade right to this scene. And, you know – you know, I mean, I would argue probably until the final episode, this is the most famous scene in MASH, probably one of the most famous scenes in television history.
And it is
just delivered pitch perfect. I love that, you know, Radar comes in and Trapper admonishes him to put a mask on. Hawkeye makes a joke. And, you know, I mean, of course, in the moment, it's, you know, it's a funny thing, but to realize it's the most inappropriate joke imaginable, because there's nothing funny about what's about to happen. And I like that when Radar starts to talk, there's still a lot of activity. You know, you're still hearing people shuffling around and instruments clanking and things getting moved. And then as the group starts hearing him, they know something has happened. And you can hear the room get quiet, which is great. I love that everyone in the room sort of simultaneously figures out, wait a minute, this is something's happened. And it gets very, very quiet. And then just the way Gary Berghoff delivers this. And I can't, you know, I mean, I've never done acting. I've never had any inclinations to be an actor. I can only imagine how many ways Gary Berghoff must have rehearsed this. What's the best way to do it? Is it to put some emotion into it? Is there some – but the way he just relays it, like he just is reading it off paper, because he just has no – he has no faculty for how to even – process what he's about to tell everybody.
Well, that's a huge testament to Gary Berghoff. I mean,
yes.
Again, in that interview with Larry Gelbart, he talks basically they didn't rehearse this.
Yeah,
he just did it.
Yeah,
they read it, and then there was a first take. They had done the take. Gary Berghoff came in. He had the only dialogue in that. He came in, and Gelbart says he delivered it spot on, perfectly. As soon as they panned across, the shot was done, and he said, and he, you know, cut. The camera guy comes and says, "We got to do it again." Mm-hmm. There was a shadow here, messed this up, and he thought, "Oh, you know, we got to do this again." He said, and then Gary Berghoff comes out and does it just as well or better. Mm-hmm. He said he took that moment in between, and he was saying goodbye to Henry Blake, and he was saying goodbye to McLean Stevenson, mm-hmm. and it just the emotion was just dripping with that.
Yeah.
And then of course the famous, as they pan across in the second take, unscripted, the scalpel drops.
Which is the perfect thing. That is
the perfect,
perfect
thing. And Gelbart said that too. And every time I see that, I think of that too. It's that it broke sort of the silence,
mm-hmm.
but it was unscripted, but it was the perfect symbol of the fact that people die in war, but we have to save who we can.
Yeah.
On this operating table, we go on. And unfortunately, the war goes on too.
Yeah,
and that was sort of that clink of the scalpel. Their job, their mission still goes on, and that to me was just heart wrenching, and so perfect and unscripted. That just was just amazing to me.
Yeah, it's complete serendipity.
Yes, like
said,
absolutely.
I said the pan across. I love that Frank. You know, Frank looks upset. You know, I mean,
yes.
Frank is just, you know, I mean, we know that Frank's a terrible person, but he's got some redeeming qualities. And in this moment, he's horrified. Margaret is just losing it. You know, Margaret is just crying. And then poor Father Mulcahy has got his his hand. I'm losing it as I'm talking about it. I'm getting, you know, because it's like, and I've seen this 4,000 times. And I'm still just like, as I'm analyzing it on a granular level, I'm like, good Lord, this is tough. Okay, he's got his Bible out, and he's just clutching his crucifix, which is great. We even see Igor. Igor's in the back. He's holding, and he just looks at someone else silently. I like that they put Igor in here. I mean, they virtually got everyone. I mean, there's no Zale. But other than that, everyone else is here, but I like that. And then as we get to Klinger, we hear that instrument drop. And yeah. I can only imagine whoever dropped that thing must have, like, been, oh God, no, I ruined the take. And then you realize, no, you made this take.
Right.
Because the way, and not only does it drop, but it, you know, because the room is so silent, it rattles around like it's an empty warehouse.
Yeah.
It's fantastic.
Yeah, and like you said, you know, some of the people in the background sort of look at each other, but the main cast don't really look at each other.
No.
They look like it's, if I look at somebody else, I'm going to lose it.
Yep.
They're working hard to maintain control.
Yeah.
And I thought they all played it so very well.
Yeah. So then Klinger is just staring straight ahead. And again, there's no good reason for Klinger to be the nurse in this scenario. But of course, they did it so they could get him in the scene.
Yes.
And both Hawkeye and Trapper are just staring down at their patient. And then there is a moment where Trapper looks up at nothing and just sort of stares for a moment. And then Hawkeye looks up and just sort of scans the room. They don't look at each other. Trapper makes a brief kind of slight head turn to Hawkeye, but they don't look at each other. Then they look back down, and then that is it. Then they fade to black. Then we get a little goodbye to Henry Blake. We have the announcer, and there's a little clip scene of all the various moments featuring Henry Blake, but some music over it. Now, in my version that aired in syndication in Channel 29, this little bit is cut. And so, if anything, it makes the show that much more brutal, because in the syndicated version, it goes right from the death of Henry Blake to the end credits. I mean, so it's like, my Lord, talk about a gut punch. It's like a gut punch plus a second gut punch, because this little interstitial here at the end with the clips of Henry, it does soften the blow a little bit. Because you're getting a nice little – you're getting a couple scenes of Henry being goofy over some music. But, I mean, man, the syndicated version, that is just, oh, Henry's dead. Goodbye, everybody, end credits. And you're like, wow.
Right, and with that silence leading into the end credits.
Yeah.
I mean, just the – you know, normally where you have some laugh take or, you know, music or whatever leading into the end credits, it would be so stark without that clap.
Oh, man.
Which, powerful, too. But
now,
stark.
What do you think about this little montage at the end? Do you like it? Do you think that it softens the blow too much? Getting some shots of goofy Henry Blake over some kind of slightly lighter music before we go, or do you think it's necessary to just dial it down a little bit?
I mean, it's hard to say in the context of the early to mid 1970s, because I think it was probably there for that. But I think in some ways is that sort of that remembrance of, again, thinking of it as we lost someone we love, but we need to remember why we love them, kind of a sense. I think there probably would have been more power. It would have been more powerful message if they hadn't done that. But I do think they wanted to soften the blow. And I think it's probably okay that they – I'm really okay if they – either way. But I think it probably is okay to soften the blow, because I think that's also real life. Trying to remember why you love someone that's gone, not just they're gone. And that's it.
Yeah. It's – yeah. Oh, man. Like I said, I can still remember the syndicated one and just – oh, man. And then I – you know, then I got the DVDs and there was this thing at the end. I'm like, oh, okay. They put this little softener here at the end. All right. That's fine. Okay.
And I felt like when I saw it first in the 90s, that clip – I did not see the clip part either.
Right.
When I saw the broadcast, it ended with Radar's message and the pan across, and that was it.
Oof, man.
And it was stark. Like,
yeah, so.
What?
Yeah. And this thing resonated outside of the culture. I mean, there was a cameo by McLean Stevenson as Henry Blake on The Cher Show. Now, for many years before the internet, when this thing couldn't be spread, it was attributed to the Carol Burnett Show, and it had supposedly aired on the Carol Burnett Show the night after this episode aired. That's not true for a number of reasons. First of all, it wasn't the Cal Burnett show. Second of all, Cal Burnett aired on Saturdays, and at this point, MASH was on Tuesdays, so it couldn't have been that anyway. But it was the Cher show on May 4th, 1975. McLean Stevenson was a guest star on the Cher variety show that she had. And there is a scene, and you can find it on the internet, of McLean Stevenson dressed as Henry Blake in a raft. And he's singing, "I'm okay, I'm okay." And it was kind of this cheap. And, you know, you watch it and you say, that's funny. But at the same time, it feels a little like, I don't know. I don't know if it's a little on the tasteless side in some ways.
It was a little bit of an eye roller. But I feel like they were probably saying, if that was in that interregnum between the next season, like,
yeah,
hey, we could bring him back. You know, if they wanted to, they could write that. They could have made some comedy out of it. He had spun out. They find him stranded on some island. I mean, they could have written all kinds of stuff to bring him back, which they would never have done.
No,
but it was like they were trying to play up that comedic side for that particular show and that particular take on it.
I think it suggests that maybe McLean Stevenson was not the greatest picker of material in his post-MASH career. And you know, this gets to something that is always, to me, always worth pursuing is like, I there's a phrase in the culture about all of God's children deserve to be judged on their best work. And I've always liked that phrase because you always look at, you know, it, to me, it's a generous phrase because you like to say, well, what was this person at their best? And you look at him. Yeah. McLean Stevenson's career post MASH was pretty dire. You know, Hello Larry or the McLean Stevenson show. I mean, he just did a lot of crap. You know, I mean, not to put too fine a point on it. And so, of course, after he became a poster boy for the guy who left the popular show and tanked his career. Now, right. We have to be fair to McLean Stevenson in a number of ways. First of all, McLean Stevenson was great on MASH. He was wonderful. Yes, he was given great material, which always helps, but he delivered it really well. And he created this wonderful character. So when he does die, it breaks your heart. So McLean Stevenson was a great actor. The fact that he was not given the opportunity to be a great actor and didn't really get the chance to have a lot of good material after this is the vagaries of a show business career. I do remember watching the PBS miniseries Tales from the City, the adaptation of the Maupin books, and he's in that, and he's great in that. And I was so happy to see him because it was more of a dramatic role, and I was like, oh, wow, look at McLean. Oh, he's great in this. So, you know, he was, even as an older man, he was still capable of being a really good actor. It was just he wasn't given a lot of chances post-MASH. Now, again, you might say, why would somebody leave a hit series? Well, you know, behind the scenes, there was apparently, you know, the MASH actors were not treated terribly well, even by the network, even though they were producing a hit show. There was a lot of apparently bad blood between the network and the actors. And McLean Stevenson, apparently, just by the dint of his personality, was one of the more vocal people about, you know, trying to fight for the cast. They talked about how, you know, like parsimonious CBS was with, you know, giving them a rehearsal tent. They had, all they wanted was a room to rehearse their lines. And you know, the network was like, no, you don't have money for that. And, you know, can I get a phone in my dressing room? No, we don't have any money for that. Like, what are you talking about? We're on a hit show. You know, what do you, you know, that kind
yeah.
of thing.
Yeah. And early on, they were saying they really didn't even have dressing rooms.
Yeah.
I mean, they were in some tent.
Yeah.
And you, like you said, McLean Stevenson said that several times. They wanted places to sit down between takes. They had to stand. They had no chairs.
Yeah.
And one thing he said too, I was finding this interview with him, and he said, we just wanted a place to go to the bathroom. There was no place on set. We had to go into the makeup room just to use the bathroom on set. And McLean Stevenson says, his quote was, I couldn't understand why we had to ask for these things.
Mm-hmm.
As if, you know, that's just a fundamental, basic, you know, comfort that you should have on a set. And like you said, they were obviously at odds there. He seemed to be the most vocal about it.
And obviously, I mean, the network was obviously turning to Alan Alda as the star of the show. And of course, if you're McLean Stevenson, you're kind of like, well, I'm not, you know, the network's treating me differently than they're treating some of the other actors. And I'm getting the fast two-step, and I could see. And at the same time, again, hard to remember these things because you're talking 40 years ago. McLean Stevenson had hosted the Tonight Show in place of Johnny Carson when Johnny Carson took the nights off. a lot. Like, he's one of the most frequent guest hosts of all, in the run of the Tonight Show. And there were some talks of like, well, you know, maybe you could host your own talk show. So there was probably a lot of people blowing smoke in his direction, saying, you know, you're going to be able to springboard this into a greater career. And so he decided, well, let me do it. And then because it didn't turn out, that's not necessarily his fault. And unfortunately, as you can see, most of the time when an actor leaves a hit show, it doesn't work out. George Clooney is like the one example I can think of who left a hit show and went on to something even greater. But basically, you've got like the David Carusos and the Shelley Longs, the people who left a hit series and then their career just never quite lived up to that. And there's a tendency to blame the actor. Like, you're like, oh, you're fully yourself. And you could argue, you know, why would you ever leave a hit show? That said, it's like this moment turned MASH into MASH. You know,
right.
I mean, it like,
right.
I mean, there, it's hard to extrapolate what might have happened, but would MASH have continued to be as popular as it became if Trapper, because of course this is Trapper's List episode two, if Trapper and Henry had never left the show, if they had just kept making this show, would they have run out of stories with these same six characters? Maybe MASH would have run six seasons. And they would have burned itself out. But by the fact that they had to renew itself with new characters, it breathed new life into the show. So you could argue, boy, you shouldn't have left a hit show. Yeah, but maybe MASH wouldn't have been MASH had it not had this moment.
And like we said, you know, this was something it turned. It became more, had more dramatic features. And it became more individual character-driven stories. And not only characters of the main cast. Before, I felt like it was sort of situational comedy. Again, sitcom. They had situations, and they were always kind of on about the military establishment and kind of beating on that all the time. And that kind of over time turned a little bit more to these character-driven stories and topical-driven stories instead. And like you said, the chances that they would have done that with the cast they had before, and we haven't even mentioned yet, this was Wayne Rogers' last episode either. We lost really the two characters, certainly. And so the two major characters, the turn was even more significant as well.
Yeah, I always, as a kid watching the show, I was always very, very interested in the episodes where they mentioned the past characters, because I felt like it just gave weight to the show. The idea that it's kind of like when you are in when you're working somewhere, you're working in a job, and you get to be friends with someone, and then they leave the job. And they go somewhere else. And if you're lucky enough, you stay friends with them through other means. But nevertheless, it's like a weird thing that this person you were so close with is just gone. You know, you're used to these parameters, and now this person's not there anymore. And it's almost like they've died. Like they're just gone. And it changes the chemical balance of what
yes.
this thing is. And so, like I said, I don't think MASH would have achieved the heights that it achieved had it not done these things that it had to do by the characters leaving. It wouldn't have been able to give that extra dimension to Hawkeye, to Radar, to the others by working in these new characters. And it would have never have done that if Wayne Rogers and McLean Stevenson had said, oh yeah, no, we'll sign up for season four. No problem. I mean, so it's McLean Stevenson almost had to sacrifice his career to make MASH a better show. And then you were like, well, the show, you know, never should have left. Well, you know, he didn't know that at the time. Nobody knows.
So you make the decision based on what you have in front of you at the time.
Exactly.
And like you said, Stevenson was obviously upset about some of what he perceived as the poor working conditions. And he said it. I mean, he had been part of an ensemble cast.
Yeah.
And he wanted to be him.
Yeah.
Him. Wayne Rogers was a little bit different story as far as I think maybe why he left. I mean, he had some interesting thoughts on that too. Do you want to talk about that now? I've got some stuff here.
Before I get to Wayne Rogers, I do want to mention one other couple of funny
sure.
things in terms of the cultural impact of this. I did find a newspaper article from the Lowell, Massachusetts Sun, which aired the newspaper article about this episode, about this Abyssinian Henry. That article ran the same day as this episode, which means it was in newspapers before, but people saw the show. It mentions that Henry dies. in the article.
Yes.
I cannot imagine how mad you would be if you had read that article, had not seen the show that night, and have it ruined. Now, it does it in a elliptical way in that it mentions the film Mr. Roberts. And it says, if you've seen Mr. Roberts, you know what we're referring to. Well, for anyone who hasn't seen Mr. Roberts, spoiler alert for a 65-year-old movie, Mr. Roberts dies at the end, Henry Fonda dies at the end of that film. But nevertheless, Mr. Roberts was a famous movie, and it was only 20 years old by the time this episode aired. So they gave it away, which is, I couldn't believe it. I couldn't, when I read that article, I was like, I thought maybe they ran it the next day. Nope.
Which would have made sense.
Which made sense. It would have totally made sense, but they ran it that day, which is nuts. And then again, some other references I wanted to mention in St. Elsewhere, another show that I think owes a lot to MASH in terms of its mixture of drama and comedy. In the final episode of St. Elsewhere, which of course was groundbreaking in its own way for people who haven't seen that show, but there's a reference in where there is a character down in the morgue performing an autopsy, and they have the thing where there's like the microphone dangling down, so it's recording what the surgeon is finding, and the doctor starts reading off the name of the patient, and it says patient Blake, Henry, died from injuries sustained in a helicopter crash. And you know, in 1985, my head snapped back a little. I was like, yeah. Oh, look at that. Okay.
Those little nods. The internal nods to a nod to the importance of that episode, and for television, what changed after that as well?
Yeah, absolutely. Apparently, it was referenced in an episode of Family Guy where there's a shot of Brian, where apparently he comes in. And he says, "I have an announcement. Meg Griffin's plane was shot down over the Sea of Japan. It spun in. There were no survivors." I've never seen that episode, but it only underscores my feeling that Family Guy is garbage. And then in the novel In Country, the 1985 novel In Country by Bobby Ann Mason, the teenage protagonist recalls having watched this episode as a child and being so shocked that she went around stunned for days, and confesses that Henry Blake's death on the show had seemed more real to her than the death of her own father in Vietnam. So this was something that lingered in a lot of people's memories for a very long time.
Absolutely. So. You know, like you said, the show had touched people in the way that it touched people. And that just was – that had not happened before. I mean, I can't emphasize that enough. That we see deaths all the time now on TV shows, and that just didn't happen then.
No. So, all right. Well, we have to talk about that. This is also Trapper John's final episode. We don't know that. Nobody knew that. I'm assuming that Wayne Rogers didn't necessarily know. He knew that he was unhappy, but I didn't get the sense that he necessarily knew this was his – it was something that happened over the course of the summer break that he decided to leave the show. I mean, does this – obviously it's not a final Trapper episode because they didn't know it was, but how do you think it works as a goodbye for Trapper? I mean, do you feel like he gets any great moments in this show?
Not really. Not from a goodbye standpoint. I think it was just regular Trapper moments.
Right.
And strangely, I felt like from Wayne Rogers' point of view, I think that was part of the reason he left, was that he talks about — I did some research and I found a couple interviews with Wayne Rogers, and he talked about when he first came on the show and what his understanding was. And he says, "I came here with the understanding that this was a show with primarily two characters and their relationship to the McLean Stevenson character. And if that's not so, I have a solution to your problems. I can do less shows and be more involved in those. That saves you money, and I won't feel like I'm wasting my time, and I won't feel like I've being treated in some half-assed manner." The producers, they told him that wasn't acceptable, if they would go back to what they had originally said and keep him more involved. And then Rogers went on to say, he said, "Despite the change in scripts, the character of Trapper didn't grow with the material. He started to be manipulated like he was an ancillary character plastered onto the script. It didn't matter who was playing him, me or Cheem
Gnipkinop. Yeah.
Yeah. And it could have been anyone. My creative talents weren't being used. I hated to leave. I loved the people. I got to tell you, I never look back. Life must be lived." And I kind of felt like that was Trapper in this episode too. He was part of the crew, but he wasn't really given a goodbye moment by any far stretch, because they didn't know.
Yeah.
And that just kind of was a microcosm of at least Wayne Rogers' view of what Trapper had become.
Yeah, and, you know, I mean, obviously, easy to look back on it with from our vantage point.
Oh, absolutely.
In hindsight. But, I mean, and I've said this in previous episodes, I think some of Trapper's best moments on MASH came in the final third of this season, particularly, like I said, in the Love and Marriage episode. I think that's his single finest moment. And so I almost wonder, maybe they could have done more with Trapper post Henry Blake being dead, because they would have, I mean, they were obviously always going to bring in a new superior officer character. They were never just going to let it be Frank in charge.
Right.
I'm sure that was something they were never going to do. But I mean, it would have been interesting to, I mean, what would it have looked like to have Trapper John with Colonel Potter? What would that have looked like? And so there might've been room there for Trapper to have more to do or just be more interesting than what we got, but we'll never know. Obviously, we'll never know. And, you know, Wayne Rogers, unlike McLean Stevenson, I mean, Wayne Rogers' career was never, again, all that great either. He had the show House Calls, which was a relatively, you know, again, playing another doctor, a relatively minor hit at the time. But then he went on and apparently invested his money very well and became fabulously wealthy. And so, you know, I guess he seemed... I guess there's probably a certain amount of like, I'm doing all right for myself, because he did very, very well. And when he was on the reunion show, the 30th anniversary show, you know, he seemed to be just as having a good time like the rest of them. Like, you know, he didn't seem to have like a sort of a bitter attitude about it, even though he left the show on kind of acrimonious terms.
Yeah, it sounds like, though, too, that his acrimony was more toward the studio.
Right.
And again, sort of their – I hate to say treatment of the actors, but just kind of that overall, the way that the things came down from the studio level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, if you've ever read, I mean, unfortunately, it's a common thing where you hear about these shows that are on, and then the studios tend to treat these actors really poorly, and you just kind of say, God, you've created this hit show, which is really rare. You would think you would try and butter these people up, and apparently that was not really the case. So it's of course, MASH found, and we'll discuss this in season 4 of MASHcast, but MASH found a great way of getting rid of Trapper in a completely different way.
Yes.
In a completely new way of and of grounding the sense of loss when someone disappears without even you getting a chance to say goodbye.
Which, by the way, I should mention here, going back to Henry, they talk about he'd accumulated enough points to be discharged, but the point system in reality had ended in World War II.
And they never used it for doctors anyway.
So again, that was one of those things that the classic MASH that nobody really cares about that.
No.
We just need to get a way to get Henry to home, and that's the simplest way.
Yeah.
But yeah, but so that was a very different way than Trapper leaving.
Yeah, but it's remarkable because, again, you think about like how many shows have ever gotten rid of two main characters in one episode. That's pretty rare.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, again, they didn't know they were doing it, but that's pretty rare. And, you know, obviously at that point, the Void was there and Hawkeye, Alan Alda was there to really dominate the show at a certain point. But again, we'll talk about all that in season 4.
What a great segue.
When we get to it. but I mean, it's just a masterpiece of an episode. I won't say it's my favorite episode of season 3 or my favorite episode of the series at this point. You could argue it's the best episode because it is just simply – it just simply wasn't ever done before. And it was – it would be historic just for having done it, but it was done also expertly. I mean, just done absolutely perfectly.
And like you said, for me, I can't say it's my favorite episode, but I do think probably it was the most important episode of the series.
Yeah, they put their flag down here, no pun intended.
Yes.
And just were saying this, anything could happen. This is, yeah, it's a sitcom. And yeah, we've got a guy who dresses like Carmen Miranda. And, you know, yeah, we've got practical jokes and we've got silliness. But this is still a war. And people die in wars. And people don't just die in wars because they've got a gun in their hand and they're fighting the enemy because they're in a foxhole. These are people that are, you know, on a plane home and they could still die.
And they're good people. They're good people. We like, that are our family, that are our friends, that could be anyone that we know.
Yeah. And it said it's tough to do. It's tough to deliver a gut punch to an audience that feels genuine. It feels organic to the show. It's kind of like, you know, again, I'm going to reference something else, but I remember reading a book about the Star Trek movies. And, you know, originally when they brought up the idea that Spock dies in Star Trek. Spoiler alert: Spock dies in Star Trek Two. The original, apparently, they, you know, the original pass on the script, people weren't happy with it because it seemed forced and it just was jammed into the screenplay. And they said, "Look, we can do this. We can kill Spock. We got to kill him well. We can't just kill him off for the shock, because then people will hate us. We have to find an organic way of making it fit into the story, so where people will be upset, but they will be feel rewarded because we got there in a natural way." And of course, they did.
Right.
And so that's what works here. It works perfectly. That final scene again is one of the most historic pieces in all of television, and it's just a brilliant episode. And it made MASH what it was. I mean, MASH was already a great show, and this just cranked it up to, like, you know, 11, basically. And like I said, it says something about the power that even as I was rewatching that scene while we were doing this, I was getting upset, because it's just so and to watch the other characters react in all different ways and just have no work. And again, the temptation had to be to give somebody some lines, and then to be able to think about it and say, no lines. Nobody's going to say anything.
Yeah, and again, we talked about it, but the idea that they just used sort of the diegetic sound in there, the sound that was on the film. There was no laugh track, no music, and the scalpel. Just it was the background noise that you would hear in a normal operating room.
Yeah,
that was it.
Brilliant.
That to me was just so powerful.
So I already mentioned my favorite line from the show is the "you behave yourself or I'll come back and kick your butt." I do love Radar, you know, Henry's hot dog. I love that. He's great. And then Hawkeye hugging Radar is my favorite moment. Do you have a particular favorite line or joke from the episode?
It was really hard for me to focus on jokes in
because
I knew what was coming.
Yeah.
But I think for me, it was one that we already mentioned. It was that I would say when I traced you when you were sleeping. For whatever reason, that one always makes me laugh. And the other one too that strangely makes me laugh is I don't want your mother wearing my suits, but just because it's so random to me, it was so random. Then he puts his hand over the phone and says, she dressed as Conrad Nagel to go to a party, and that was just so random that it made me laugh. And the gag part was one you already mentioned too, was Klinger in the Carmen Miranda suit, where Henry then zips him up at the end too, and Klinger gives him, "Sir, I'd like you to have a photo of me for your wallet." Your pink nightdress.
Your favorite, sir.
So those are the ones that that just always get me to chuckle, even though I know what's coming.
Yeah, it is. It's very hard to watch this show and almost laugh at any of it, because you know what's coming. You know, you're just like, oh, okay, yeah, all right, everybody. But yeah, it's just a remarkable episode. I mean, we could just go on and on saying how remarkable it is, but this is the kind of stuff that makes me call the show the greatest TV series of all time without any hesitation. I honestly believe this is the greatest television show of all time, and I think if anything, the show's going to get even better as we go on, if that's even a possible thing. But we'll talk about that again in season four. So, Scott, that's going to do it for Abyssinia Henry.
Can I add one thing?
Absolutely.
You're ending on that
note? No, go right ahead.
Abyssinia Henry. Larry Gelbart talked about that too, about why they called it Abyssinia Henry. He just said Abyssinia was a term from the 1920s, which is just slang for "I'll be seeing you."
I'll be seeing you, right.
But he said that was really kind of a dorky line, mm-hmm. but Henry Blake was dorky, and we thought that it fit in with his character, and that's part of how we wanted to say goodbye to him.
He even says it once in an episode when he's on the phone. He says, "I'll be seeing you."
Private Charles Lamb, maybe?
Might be. I know there's one where he says it, yeah.
Yeah, I think that might be what it was. But yeah, but he mentioned it one other time too. And then, of course, in my head, I'm like, were they foreshadowing again? Were they mm-hmm. knowing what was coming? You know, I think about all that stuff. But yeah, so Abyssinia Henry.
Yeah, it's just an amazing, amazing piece of television. So, well, Scott, thank you. Thank you for volunteering to do this one, because, again, this is some heavy lifting. I always enjoy talking to you. You know, as I enjoy your appearances on the Fire and Water Podcast Network. And so I thank you once again for coming by.
My pleasure to be here. Look forward to hopefully getting together on something else in the near future.
Absolutely. So, of course, everybody, if you want to follow the show, go to our website, fireandwaterpodcast.com. You can subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. We're always talking MASH over on Twitter at MASH477Cast. You can support the Fine Water Podcast Network by going to patreon.com/FW Podcast, and there you can unlock various rewards, one of which is to be name-checked on a show of your choice. So a big salute to Nicholas Prom, Russell Burbage, Stan Peel, Dolph DeVries, and Britt Schramm for their support of MASHcast. So this is not going to be quite the end of MASHcast Season 3. We, of course, have the mail call episode where I'm going to go through all the feedback that we've gotten for the previous season. That episode is going to air in October. And as I mentioned at the last mail call episode, if you out there, because this episode is so titanic, if you out there have thoughts on Abyssinia Henry, and you want to share them with the shit with everyone here on the show, record a little segment on your own, like make it just a couple of minutes long, and send it to firewaterpodcast@comcast.net, and we can include it in the mailbag show. The deadline for that is going to be October 1st. So if you have some thoughts on Abyssinia Henry that you would like to be included on the mail call episode, make sure you get it in to firewaterpodcast@comcast.net. by October 1st, and I will do my best to make sure it's included in the mailbag episodes. So the mailbag episode will be coming. That will be our final episode of Season 3. And then I do have some other special shows that will be popping up in between the sort of the downtime between the end of this and then the beginning of MASHcast Season 4, which will be coming eventually. I have to take a little break and gear up for that show, for that season, which is, I still say, is the greatest season of television ever produced, ever. But we'll talk about that when we get there. So thank you, everybody, for listening. Thanks to all of my guests for coming by. Thank you again, Scott. Once again, you know this is just a great way to end MASH Season 3. So thanks, everybody, for listening. And until the mail call episode, that is all.
MASH 4077 bids Henry Blake a reluctant and affectionate farewell.